The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Warning! This episode contains foul language and mentions of murder, sexual abuse, bullying, drug usage, and death by soda machine.
Listening to Keep It Weird, the podcast for all things strange and unusual, literary and cinematic, horrifying and nostalgic, and sometimes we venture into the dead zone. This week especially, we're hopping into our 1958 Plymouth Furies, rolling up our Rita Hayworth posters, and heading into Derry as we chat about the man, the myth, the legend, Stephen King. He's published 64 novels, 5 nonfiction books, has written over 200 short stories, has had at least 80 movie adaptations made from his work, and has inspired writers, horror movie junkies, and losers like us for over 50 years. In this episode, we're going to talk about how on earth he could possibly still be churning out a novel every year at age 74, our favorite books, movies, and short stories, and reminiscing over our most beloved characters, spookiest scares, and most tender moments. Today we find out why sometimes dead is better. My name is Ashley, and this is my lovely co-host, Lauren.
Hello, weirdos.
And joining us today, one of the biggest King fans in history, so big he has his own podcast dedicated to Stevie himself, from one of my favorite shows out there, the Losers Club podcast, it's Randall Colburn.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Yay. Hi, Randy. It's so nice to have you on our show. I got to go on yours a couple weeks ago, and it was awesome.
Yes, we loved having you on, and we look forward to having you on more.
Yeah, I'm coming on for Everything's Eventual. So
yeah, which has been a fun reread.
Has so far. I haven't read it since, I think, eighth or ninth grade. Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah.
Randall, first of all, introduce yourself, plug your show, but also tell us what got you into Stephen King.
What got me into Stephen King was the 1994 Stand miniseries, which was on ABC, I believe. My brother, someone, like, borrowed the double VHS set, and I think I just watched it when I got home from school one day. I was always scared of horror, and there was something accessible about that because it was a network TV thing, so it couldn't get too violent,
right.
But I loved sort of the big ensemble of it, and I kind of really fell in love, and then I got the book, which was, you know, the uncut 1,200-page version.
Huge-ass book.
Yeah, and I was really young at the time, but I saw that as sort of a huge, I don't know, it was like a daunting sort of thing, and something I was very excited to sort of tackle as a very young person. I was always reading dark stuff when I was way too young. I stole, like, Helter Skelter, the Charles Manson book, from my mom's closet when I was, like, probably 9. Yeah, and I was obsessed with it. And it was funny because I'd already read half of it, and, you know, I read all the bloodiest parts, and my mom was like, oh my god, why'd you take that? And then she saw how far I was, and she's like, well, you already read the dark shit, so let's just talk about it. So she was cool about it. But I was kind of just a diehard fan, and he really influenced a lot of my work. And then, you know, I went through my college phase of thinking I was too smart for Stephen King or so on and so forth. But then, you know, you eventually, I think one of the parts of growing up is re-embracing a lot of the things you loved from sort of an adult perspective. And totally. And honestly, that was kind of what the podcast, which the Losers Club podcast, which we started in 2017, me and a bunch of my friends here in Chicago, we were all working for a site called Consequence of Sound at the time. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to start a podcast just because we thought we would be good at it, because we're already like,
right.
Like whenever we hang out, it's like my wife describes it as like a snake eating its own tail, because we just talk and talk and talk. And, you know, we figured, well, why not? Like, we have a lot of shared interests, and we, you know, one of the things we knew is we all love Stephen King. And so we kind of just embarked on this journey, and we had no idea if anybody would listen. And here we are 5 years later, and we just interviewed Stephen King like a couple weeks ago. So
I know.
It was
insane.
Yeah, it was really cool. And you know, it was neat. I mean, and you know, that was never the point of the podcast, was to interview Stephen King. We really wanted to approach it from a critical, like, sort of literary perspective, because, mm-hmm. you know, we're not really into fan casts, and we all kind of come from critical writing, and we didn't want to, like, start a podcast to trash Stephen King, obviously. Why would you commit yourself to that? But, you know, I think part of the joy of loving Stephen King is also hating him a little bit, because he'll write the most beautiful sentence you've ever read, and then he'll write the worst sentence you've ever read. And that's sort of the unique joy of King, is that he can be so high-minded and literary, and then be so, like, he'll just write about farts for, like, 10
basic,
pages.
Basic,
right.
And,
yeah.
Yeah.
He can be a
and
basic
sometimes
bitch,
it's great.
For sure.
Yeah. And sometimes it doesn't work, but, and we'll talk about some of that later, I'm sure. But yeah, so you can check that out, you know, wherever you listen to podcasts. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/thebarons. And yeah, and I mean, you know, and elsewhere outside of that, I'm, you know, I'm a writer. Currently, I'm an editor at Entertainment Weekly, but I also, you know, worked at a lot of different media sites over the years. And as Ashley knows, I've also worked as a playwright extensively, and I'm currently writing a novel as well. So a lot of various things I'm dipping my toe in. So yeah.
That's awesome.
Did you guys meet in college? I actually just realized I don't know mm-hmm. how you two met. Okay, it was college.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, we went to college together. He was an upperclassman when I was a lowerclassman? Lowerclassman, right? Not underclassman? Yeah.
Oh. So, is it underclass? It is.
I actually, as I was saying it, I was like, lowerclassman?
I know.
No, so Rachel, who was just on the show, we did a biology episode with her. You were around her age, so they were a little older than me. Yeah, I was kind mm-hmm, of the new kid on the block, so I didn't get to hang. But we've obviously remained friends over the years, and we started our podcast in the same year. Lauren and I started in 2017 too, and I remember kind of like reaching out to you and being like, "You have a podcast too."
Yeah, she has been talking about you guys for like such a long time, because it felt like we came up at the same time, and then suddenly we mm-hmm. were like, "Wow, Losers Club is killing it over there!" Like, you guys are it's been fun to watch.
Yeah, I wish we would have been able to connect earlier. I think it just, you know, it slips off people's radar sometimes.
Yes.
But, but I'm glad we finally did.
Scheduling's a nightmare. Me too.
I know. Now Ashley gets to do all of her Stephen King loving on your show. It's the best.
Yeah, and I definitely can be critical. I'm more critical, I think, of the film adaptations than I am of his original works. Oof. But I'm such a fangirl over Stephen King. Like, even when it's bad, it's still good for me. Like, even when it's bad, I'm like, you know what? Did I waste 20 hours? No. No, I did not.
There's really nothing else like him, you know, and I think that's
true.
Something we're realizing. One of the new series we started on the pod is, we call it On Writers, and which is very clever, I know. And we just interview like other fiction, horror fiction writers, me and my friend Mel, who we have like a really kind of big contributor base at Losers Club, so we kind of all have our beats. And Mel is a very literary friend of mine, and so she and I decided we wanted to, you know, talk to other modern horror authors, because one of the questions we always get is like, well, if I like Stephen King, who else can I read? And honestly, there's a lot of horror writers out there, but there's few people that do what he does. And so I think one of the things we wanted to do was talk to other modern horror writers who we know love him. And I think most modern horror writers do, because it's kind of hard not to be influenced by him.
Yeah.
And sort of ask them, like, who do you think are, you know, obviously we talk to people we like and we recommend their work, but then they also sort of tell us where we should be looking to scratch that itch. So it's been a fun series we've been doing.
Love that.
Lauren, you have a different relationship with Stephen King. How did you get into Stephen King?
Oh, gosh. I think it started with, I mean, so cliche, but I think it started with The Shining because I saw that at a way too young age.
And yeah, for sure.
Was just
the TV version or the Kubrick?
Kubrick. So okay. It was like, it's so funny because I think I've talked about this on the show before. It took me until adulthood to fully understand The Shining and appreciate it. And obviously all of the, you know, symbolism going in that, of course. But I remember watching it as a kid and being so fascinated by it and thinking, like, who is this guy? And then my dad being so ashamed, like, looking at me like, you don't know Stephen King's work? And he just had, like, a
You're
mountain
like, dad,
of
I'm
Stephen
seven.
King books. Yeah, I'm a child. No, my dad has always loved Stephen King. He's liked a lot of horror writers. And speaking of basic bees, as we said before, like, Dean Koontz is another one
totally.
My dad enjoys. And he had all of them. But mostly, he would brag about, you know, how he had read every Stephen King book and was such a big fan, blah, blah, blah. So it was kind of my dad taking me under his wing and being like, okay, if you have interest in this, let's look into this. And definitely, I am more heavy on the movies than the books, which I know you two are much more into the books. But COVID, with nothing to do, had me reading some more. So I'm finally getting more Stephen King books under my belt, which has been so fun because the books are definitely better for the most part, yeah. And it took me years to find that out, but I'm happy to be a part of it now.
Well, welcome. I, as our listeners have probably heard, horror movies basically shaped my entire life growing up. My house was the house you went to if you wanted to see Nightmare on Elm Street or Tales from the Crypt in third grade.
Yep. Your house would be the one I would beg to sleep over at so I could watch.
And my mom got a couple calls that was like, what did you let my child watch at your house? My mom's like, I'm not responsible for what my psycho daughter shows your kids.
Sorry about it.
But I obviously loved movies like Pet Sematary, Carrie, Creepshow, but I didn't know that they were based on books and stories by the same guy. And I think it was probably fifth grade, when I got a copy of Night Shift, which was a short story collection.
Oh, yeah.
And I got it specifically because I was told, I think my aunt told me that Children of the Corn was a short story by this guy, Stephen something. And so I devoured this book, and the next book I read was It, which is insane because That's up to this insane. Point, Night Shift was the longest book I'd ever read at 300 pages. So, 1,200 pages was pretty hefty, and it happened to be the most horrifying 1,200 pages of my life. And I actually credit Stephen King as being the reason I never read the Harry Potter books because I remember in grade school, everyone was going cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs over this Harry Potter stuff, and I tried to read it, and at that point, like, I was too far gone. I can't go from...
This is for babies.
Yeah, I can't go from an interdimensional extraterrestrial child-eating monster and, like, child sexual abuse and suicide and Munchausen by proxy and kids getting bit in half to boy wizards. I, like, missed
can't
the boat.
Go to Sorcerer's Stone. Yeah, like,
yeah, I
just
can't.
Sorcerer's Stone has nothing on Stevie King. No, that's so, totally understandable. I get it. You were just too above the rest. You were already too far.
Yeah, I just sort of, that's all I craved. I mean, I read, that's true crime and horror novels. I mean, still to this day, Jill will be like, what are you reading? And I'm like, well, someone died. And they are, and he's like, yeah, okay. Didn't know if you mixed it up.
That's what I loved about Stephen King was I was always reading true crime as well, but it was like crime only and like it was a little more realistic. And I feel like that's another credit I can give to Stephen King, like starting to read his books, was that I loved that we got to branch off into like the weirdest shit I have ever read. It's my favorite. Yeah, the fantastical, the supernatural, of course, but also just so weird. That is why I love Stephen King is every book I read, I think – How did this enter your brain as an idea? I don't understand, but I'm obsessed with it. Like it was just the kind of writing I needed in my life.
Well, today's episode is kind of our little love letter to Stephen King, who, whether you like him or not, is one of the most talented writers that has ever lived. So I'm just going to start with the basics. I'll spew a few out before we get to our questions. Stephen King was born in 1947 in Portland, Maine, which is no surprise. There's a reason most of his stories take place there. He grew up without a father. His dad left when he was, I think, 3. So he and his brother were raised by a single mom. Stephen got a bachelor's in English from the University of Maine in 1970 and married his wife, Tabitha, in 1971. and he started his writing career by submitting short stories to magazines with names like Startling Mystery Stories and Penthouse. And that's how he made some extra cash while also working as a laborer and eventually a teacher of English classes at a public high school. But his big, big break came when he wrote a story about a young girl who had the ability to move things with her mind. He actually threw the story away at first, but his wife read it and encouraged him to keep going. And thank goodness she did, because Carrie was officially published in 1974, question mark. And the paperback sold a million copies. And 3 years later, when the movie Carrie was released, they sold about 4 million more. So my first question for you guys, what do you think makes him such an impressive writer, in your opinion? Randy, you can start.
Sure. That's a, you know, big
it's
question,
a hard one.
But
yeah.
But I think there's a lot. Yeah, I think there's a lot to touch on, though. And one is just the depth of his curiosity.
Yeah.
And the absolute vastness of his imagination. I mean, one of the things I think is so interesting about King is that he's a popular fiction writer, and that that used to be a phrase that I think pre-Harry Potter had a lot more stink attached to it. And he clearly has some, I think, lingering resentment for the idea that any books that sold a lot were typically sneered upon by sort of the critical cognoscenti of like the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Specifically, like somebody like Harold Bloom, who was sort of, you know, basically the world's most famous critic in a lot of ways, and who hated King. And so that's changed a lot over the years, where I think what was literary and what was popular, and obviously Harry Potter had a lot to do with this, is blended. But I think one of the things that you'll notice about a lot of popular fiction writers is that they're easy to pin down. And that doesn't mean they're not good. It just means they have kind of a specific beat, like Tom Clancy. You know, he writes about, you know, government subterfuge, things like that. Anne Rice wrote about vampires and creatures and things like that. You know, like the, Lee Child writes like the Jack Reacher books. I mean, these are guys who have specific characters and specific themes that they always touch on. King was always a little bit weirder. Like even Kuntz, like kind of had, like Kuntz was strange, and him and Crichton were actually similar in that way, which that they had a breadth that was bigger than a lot of other popular fiction writers, but it doesn't touch King, because King's books are all over the place. He revisits perhaps ideas or set pieces occasionally, but none of his books are really the same. Mm-hmm. You can't really point at one and say he's just treading old water. He's really not. And I mean, this is the guy who wrote The Green Mile also wrote It, and also wrote, you know, like Road Work, which is a Bachman book about a guy who like doesn't want to lose his house, you know? And I mean, I think if you read a lot of his short stories, specifically in Night Shift, you'll see a lot of, you know, stories about like loss. Like there's this The Last Rung on the Ladder is a non-supernatural story about losing your sister, and then The Woman in the Room is a non-supernatural story about losing your mother and dealing with watching someone you love be in intense pain and wanting to stop that. And so, you know, his work has such a breadth that I think is so impressive. And then the thing is, he can turn out really beautiful sentences. But he also has this sort of connection to pop culture that a lot of literary writers don't have. And I'll say that that's sort of a blessing and a curse. Because sometimes especially in his early work, it does help it feel more urgent a little bit. Like, well, it can also feel pretty cringe at times too. But like, you know, read The Dead Zone and you feel like this is a guy who has his finger on the pulse of politics and paranoia as it existed in the country at that time. But, you know, that's, I think, shifted a little bit. Like if you read his latest book, Billy Summers, which isn't a bad book at all. He's got like two pages where a character watches The Blacklist on NBC. And you're like, I don't know if I need this. And so, you know, it's like, you know, so it's, that's, I think, part of him just getting older. But the thing is, it's this curiosity, it's this sense of humor, and it's this, you know, deep well of knowledge. I mean, he's such a smart person, and a lot of people don't give him credit for it. Is, you know, he can talk to you about the literary classics, the stuff you learn about in, you know, English 405 or whatever. But he'll also, you know, he's just as influenced by the comics he read when he was a kid. And he was never ashamed of that, even when he was younger, whereas he was told by everyone, people in college, people in the newspapers, critics, everyone, that, you know, his work wasn't to be taken seriously. That kind of work wasn't to be taken seriously, but he never really abandoned his love for it. And I think because there was money in it, and he realized that because, you know, sometimes, and he's reckoned with this in a lot of his early essays, that, you know, I think he struggled with the idea of being a popular writer, because that stuff does sell, but it doesn't necessarily get you respect. And the thing that he kind of earned, right, although it took him decades, is that now he is, you know, one of the most respected writers ever. But even if you listen to our interview that we just did on Losers Club, you can tell he still has a chip on his shoulder about a few things, because I think for so many years he didn't get respect.
Yeah.
So I think that's sort of, you know, long-winded, but I could go on, trust me, but I'll pass it over to Lauren.
Yeah, I mean, Joe really likes Stephen King because he likes the stories, obviously, but also he's the biggest Red Sox fan in history. And yeah, Joe's like, if I meet Stephen King, I'm talking to him about the Red Sox.
Right.
You know what I mean? And like,
yeah,
my fiance can talk to him about the Red Sox. I can talk to him about, I don't know, ultra-terrestrials, and like, we're all going to have a good time.
You're going to have a great time with Stephen King.
What do you think makes him a good writer?
I mean, Randy took the words right out of my mouth as far as like being able to cover literally everything, because I think the biggest thing for me was learning, and okay, this is also a little nitpicking at Jeff Myers, because my dad growing up, who I said was teaching me about Stephen King, was really only leaning on the horror side, which of course I appreciate, because look where it got me today, being so fascinated by the world of horror. But it took me so long to know that Shawshank Redemption and Green Mile were tied back to Stephen King, and those are two movies that we also watched in our house so often growing up. Still to this day, I can't watch Green Mile without shedding all of the tears. And I can't get through the book without shedding every single... You know, it's like, I could not believe that those stories were tied to the same man. But then at the same time, I'm like, of course, because there's so much character building, which brings me to like, that's the main point of why I think he's so impressive, is the way he builds characters. And I know there are other authors who are very good at that as well that we could go on about. But I like that specifically in the horror genre, he really builds up the characters, because I think it makes all of those, you know, jumpier, more terrifying scenes that he sets up for us, they mean more and they terrify us more, because we are connecting with the character so well. And I mean, he has so many stories that only involve two people that you can obviously get heavily involved with. But then you get something like The Stand or Salem's Lot, where it's like there's going to be many characters. And even in the short instances we meet them, there's a connection somehow. Like, I still will leave the book at the end being like, man, we only knew that character for a second, but I totally understood where they were coming from, how I could relate to them, blah, blah. And, you know, also just bringing the outcasts out, you know, making the nerdy kids, the kids who were bullied, coming out to be the main characters. I feel like I hadn't really seen that done before until some of Stephen King's earlier work. And I love that the outcast had a voice. And I love that that also is its own form of terror, kind of bringing back your childhood trauma and memories, because I know I was bullied in middle school and a little bit in junior high. And so I read some of those stories and I'm like, yep, I am cringing just reading this sentence right
remembering.
Now. So. Remembering it all. He paints such a beautiful picture of his characters. And I really like that, where it's like they're characters that are going through a lot. Almost all of them are, you know, struggling with something, which I know we'll probably jump into more of that later. But like, they're sympathetic characters at the same time that we can relate to. And I think he does it in such a special way.
Yeah, ignoring the sheer volume of work he's put out, there are a lot of people that release a novel a year. But I always look at the first decade of his career alone when he was publishing novels. And like, in the first 10 years, he published Carrie, Salem's Lot, The Shining, The Stand, The Dead Zone, Firestarter, Cujo, The Running Man, Christine, and Pet Cemetery. And those aren't even the only books he published in those 10 years. Those just so happen to be the books that everyone in America has heard of, because they are literally some of the most famous horror stories of all time.
Yeah.
And just the fact that they all came from the same person is just kind of wild to think about. And, you know, like I said, that was just the first 10 years. He's been giving us work for 50. And I also like, listeners, if you haven't and you're interested, even if you're not necessarily a Stephen King fan, because my friend Kelly just listened to the audiobook, and she doesn't read Stephen King, but she just listened to what is kind of his memoir. It's called On Writing. And when I read it, one, it's just so funny. It's so wonderful. I also feel like the universe conspired to create him sometimes. Like when when I look at like his life and like the way that he's brought it into everything, and just with all of his characters, characters that have substance abuse issues, characters that have that are writers, characters that have abandonment issues, characters who are children seeing other kids die, which happened to him when he was a kid. And it, what you were saying, Randy, earlier about like the horror magazine thing, and like the era in which he grew up was also perfect to create him too, with like horror magazines coming out, the Twilight Zone. Like it really was just a bunch of things that were like, this is making a perfect person for what he's
like
going
to
do.
Perfect formula to make him. Yeah. And you're right. Like everything he's been through has then come out in his books in different ways. And it's like, I'm so sorry you went through all of this trauma, but also thank you,
but
because
also,
this book is genius.
Kind of glad it happened.
Yeah. You know, there's really not a lot of mystery to him, honestly, which is something that's, I mean, there is like to some degree, but like we have a series called Archives in our Patreon where we read a lot of his unpublished or uncollected or more rare works, and we discuss those. And that's actually proven to be, that series has almost evolved into discussing, you know, life details or eras of King, like things that were happening to him personally in a more in-depth way than we can get into in our book episodes and elsewhere. And, but the thing is, like, by and large, though, On Writing is a wonderful book, but it doesn't need to be that long, you know, because it's a pretty short book.
Yeah.
Because he wears his heart in his sleeve in a lot of his books, and a lot of these stories are so autobiographical. And I think that's kind of astounding, too, in a lot of ways, is that, you know, people are always like, where are the biographies on Stephen King? And I'm like, well, I mean, I think if you just read his books, you got a pretty good idea of who this guy is.
Yeah.
There's obviously more layers. And I think, you know, specifically if you, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about in 1999 when he was hit by a van and he almost died.
Yeah.
That is kind of a really, really pivotal moment in his life. And just exploring the time right before that and the kind of months and years after that, there's a lot about King. There's a lot of darkness there, and there's a lot of and I don't know, there's a lot of humanity to unpack there that is he touches on in On Writing, but you know, when you dig through the actual news articles and some of the interviews that followed those years, there's a lot of really interesting stuff there that that you wouldn't realize is manifesting in his work, but it really does, you know.
Wow.
So interesting.
Yeah, that's fascinating. The only other thing that I was going to touch on is just the fact that, you know, you look at a lot of writers who have works the size of his, and the characters that they write through usually being close to who the writer is for these types of writers that have, you know, a book a year. And the fact that, you know, I mean, he was 25 at the time, but a 25-year-old man who can write a story from the point of view of a 15-year-old girl, and like an incredibly intimate and relatable story to me, a 15-year-old girl reading it, is incredible. Like that, that's something that I don't get to see that often. But with that all being said, we'll talk about some of our favorites. So let's start with the novel. Favorite Stephen King novel, if you have one. Randy, you can go first.
That's always hard for me to say my absolute favorite. If I if gun to my head, I would say Pet Sematary.
Okay.
I think Pet Sematary is easily in my mind his scariest book, and it also has to me the cleanest and most potent metaphor. I think one of the things about King is that he always will have, you know, he thinks about plot over theme and metaphor, which he talks about that in On Writing, which I think is a very smart way to write. But sometimes I think he does feel the pressure to kind of put a bow on things in terms of thematically.
Yeah, what did it all mean?
Yeah, and I think that's why a book like Dreamcatcher is such a mess.
Yeah.
Whereas I there's a lot to like in that book, but he really kind of tries to connect all the dots by the end, and it doesn't come together, despite how much he tries. Whereas Pet Sematary is one of the cleanest, most potent metaphors I've ever seen in horror. I mean, just the general idea of, you know, why it's, you quoted it earlier, it's like sometimes dead is better. That's all you really need to say to sum up what that book is about. And he plumbs and excavates and sort of peels away at that little sentence in such horrifying ways throughout that story. And it's his bleakest story probably, which is another reason I love it. Because sometimes I think he kind of throws in a happy ending when he hasn't quite earned it. But yeah, I love that one. But, you know, I got to throw out, like, there's a lot of others that I absolutely love. Like, Needful Things is one I come back to a lot.
Yeah.
Because I love ensembles. Like, you mentioned in Salem's Lot, mm-hmm. And The Stand. Those, I love his ensemble books is a lot. Like, Under the Dome even is a great Latter-day
yes.
one. He, like, in all those books, usually the main character is the least interesting one.
Yeah.
But
the, you get the great the rest, ensembles.
Right, but everyone else is so interesting, yeah. and I love those kind of books. So those are big faves for me too. But then, you know, it, I think obviously from an objective standpoint, is probably his masterpiece
yeah.
because it really does sort of synthesize, I think, everything that he's good at.
Yeah. yeah.
And well, I say synthesize, it's a 1,200 page book, but you know, it is sort of a grand, you know, a magnum opus in a lot of ways, I guess. And the character, you mentioned bullies earlier. I talk about this in my pod all the time. So if any of my listeners are listening, I'm sorry for talking about it again, but I'm always on the bully beat, right? Because I love the way he writes bullies.
Yeah.
And Henry Bowers in It is easily my favorite Stephen King character because he's the scariest character, I think, in all of Stephen King. And that's what King does so well is he can find humans who are scarier than interdimensional beings. You know what I mean?
Yes,
at least in
absolutely.
My opinion.
No, the bullies are so, so scary.
Yeah, and I have a lot of thoughts on bullies that I won't get into, but I'll just say that those are some of my favorite stories right there. So,
Lauren, what about you? Do you have a favorite?
I know. I hate the word favorites in everything. Like, it is not even just in
I know,
books
it's like,
and movies.
Ask
it's,
me
it's so hard.
What day of the week is it?
You'll
get a different answer.
Favorites are so hard for me because it honestly changes too. But I hate to be repetitive, but honestly, Pet Sematary is one of my favorites too.
Yeah.
yeah.
And it's for the same reason. I was like, ah, does Randy actually understand me for once? Because Ashley always criticizes me for being too dark. So not criticized, but you just know that I'm a little,
I know that you
I'm
like
a dark
to go
person.
There. Yeah.
I like to get really dark. And I also agree that I love that Pet Sematary is just fucking dark. And but it's also such a well-written story. And I actually enjoyed both movies. I know the second remake got a ton of shit, but I actually enjoyed it and whatever, we can pick it apart, but I liked that as well. And I, of course, loved It, even as massive as it is. It's one of the few that I have read twice, It and The Shining I have. And so I think that goes to show if I'm like willing to pick up that huge book again and see the movie multiple times, I must love the story. And Ashley, you'll be so proud because I hadn't finished it when we did our Vampires episode, but I finally have gotten through Salem's Lot,
hey.
Which is why I brought it up because I have been dying to finish it and actually contribute to conversation because I feel like Ashley brings it up every time we mention vampires. I'm like, I'm trying. So I did it and I really enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, for me, it will always be up there simply because it was my first novel, not just Stephen King novel. It's the first novel I ever read, so it's got to be, you know, special for me. And I did reread it as an adult, and realizing as an adult, like, nope, this is just as scary, if not scarier, as an adult, was very, like, validating for me as a 12-year-old. I was like, okay, cool. I wasn't a little pussy, because it's terrifying.
It is.
And it's interesting to me, too, that, you know, like you guys are doing with the Losers Club, like revisiting things from your childhood, because at 12, the scary parts were the giant bird and the clown and the werewolf. And
yeah.
then as an adult, you're like, oh, my God, Bevy's father is sexually and physically mm-hmm. abusing her. And like, holy shit,
it's
this homeless
people.
Man with syphilis is trying to rape Eddie. Like, it's horrific. But at the same time, that's not even the reason that it's my favorite story of his. It's the theme of friendship and like the unbreakable bonds you create with friends that you grow up with or friends that you experience trauma with, like trauma yeah. bonding. You think of soldiers and firefighters, like that sort of bond you have with someone that's almost unspeakable when you go through something horrific with them. And he's just mm-hmm. the way he writes about the connection that those kids have. But Randall, what you were saying about, you know, the characters being one of his strongest points, something that King's novels often center around are good versus evil, heroes and villains. So I do want to discuss them, and I want to know your favorite Stephen King hero and your favorite Stephen King villain. And yes, they can be the same person. And don't worry about repeating yourself. Randall, you can go first.
Hero. That's a great villain. Question. I mean, I already said Henry Bowers from It. He's probably my favorite villain in a lot of ways. But I would also say I'm a sucker for his bullies. Mm-hmm. The character Ace Merrill from The Body.
Yeah.
And also he returns in Needful Things. He's not in the movie, but he's in the book. He is a fascinating character. And the glimpses we get of that character across those two books and then in glancing mentions throughout other Castle Rock books, mm-hmm. they really do build a really compelling portrait of sort of a small town bully who, you know, basically gets swept up in things that are much bigger than him. And then Randall Flagg obviously is a wonderful villain. And, you know, he obviously manifests in a lot of different King stories in a lot of different ways that are sometimes confounding, especially if you read the Gwendy trilogy that he's been cranking out recently. There's sort of a Flagg or Flagg adjacent character, depending on how you want to look at it. And it's pretty interesting stuff. And then in terms of heroes, that's actually a harder question for me to answer, because if there's one thing that I think King struggles with to some degree, it's writing compelling heroes. But of course, hero is a flexible term. I guess when I hear hero, I think of a character like Ben Mears from Salem's Lot, or you know, Barbie from Under the Dome. These like the kind of good guy, or like Stu from The Stand, right? Like the good guys, right? And those are usually his least interesting characters. But I would also look at somebody like Jack Torrance in the book of The Shining as something of a hero, even though he gets possessed, because in the end he does have, you know, spoiler alert, he has sort of a moment of clarity that I think is really beautiful that is not in the Kubrick version, which is part of why King hates that version.
Because Dick Halloran is a hero.
He's a hero too. Absolutely. I mean, I think in King, like, and that's what I love, is my favorite books are the ones where those can be a little bit flexible. Although I think King does have sort of, and this is where it gets a little bit murky, is that his characters contain multitudes by and large, but the stories are usually defined by notions of good and notions of evil. Mm-hmm. It's just that there is, you know, there's evil in every person, but there is, I think what's the word I'm looking for? There's sort of a lack of human will that I think distinguishes someone as either, you know, good or bad. And The Stand is obviously the most clear-cut example of that, because there is, you know, literally you are split into good and evil. And I think that's the best part of discussing The Stand. We had a lot of fun in our episode doing that, is talking about what that book and the story and the adaptation say about what makes a good person and what makes a bad person. Because in the book, it is pretty complex, but it still comes down to light and dark, right?
Yeah.
And so, so I don't know. So I appreciate that, because sometimes I think there's almost too much empathy in modern horror, where I'm like, sometimes just give me a monster, you know what I mean? Like, I don't need to feel for every villain and everything I ever see, although it is nice occasionally, but that's why sometimes I like a story like Christine, where it's just an evil car.
Yeah, right. Yeah, where we don't have to talk about, like, but what do they want? It's like, I don't care what they want. Yeah. It's scary.
It's a fucking haunted car.
It's a haunted car. It's terrifying.
So, yeah, so I think that's my answer there,
Lauren?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I feel like there's so many villains, but it really is true that the humans are so much worse than the monsters, because the first one that comes to mind for me is, but I'm struggling to remember, I was trying to quickly Google it, and of course my computer is letting me down. Is Carrie's mom's name Margaret?
Yes,
Margaret. I think Margaret is horrific, like, to have as a mother. Yes, just the way it's like the abusive, like, horrible mother, but also, I mean, the way she comes across in the movie is also very scary, but just the way she's written too, you're just like, oh my God, I can't. So she comes to mind first. She terrified me when I was younger. I mean, still does, if we're being honest. And then also coming to mind, Percy from Green Mile also.
Oh, yeah, of course.
He's a monster.
Just a vile human being. And then I know this is an easy one, but also I've read it recently because it took me years to finish The Stand because it's oh so large. But I mean, Randall Flagg, I think, is just such a wonderful such a wonderful villain, as we've been saying.
I just read The Stand for the first time. It was on my Kindle for almost a decade.
You just read it too?
Yep. Over the pandemic. Yeah. I'd never read it. And like, you know, it was just one of those that just never, I think I had tried to start reading it. Cause like I said, it was on my Kindle for 10 years. So I think I had started and stopped several times. Cause there was when I did start reading it, I was like, oh yeah, I remember, you know, their blood's coming out of their eyes. Okay. But I had just read it for the first time and I actually have never seen either of the series of The Stand.
Oh shit.
So the plan now is I want to go and watch both of them back to back, starting with the one from the was it the 80s or was it the 90s?
The 90s.
90s.
Wow. 90s. You have no idea how important the 94 version is to me. And here's the thing, man. I will not blame you if you laugh your entire way through it, because it is that's the thing, is I have a lot of feelings about it. We've covered it so much on the podcast. We did an episode when we did, you know, our Stand coverage back in like 2017 or so.
Yeah.
But we also, at the beginning of the pandemic, because we're just absolute monsters, we did a 4-part series talking about each part of the of that. And then we also covered the mini series on, you know, Paramount Plus or whatever.
Yeah.
We covered that extent. We did episode by episode recaps of that. So I've discussed the adaptations very, very intimately and very complicated feelings. But I will say it's like, it's hard for me to know what it would be like to watch the 94 version as an adult, having never seen it, because so much of my feelings about it are colored by nostalgia. So.
Yeah, totally. It's so hard when you're introducing it to somebody else. And I will be interested to see how I feel about it.
I really want to hear your thoughts on it. So
I constantly think, like, if when I get like questions from people, they're like, if you could invent anything, what would it be? And I always say I would take a pill that would make me forget a movie.
Yes.
So that I could watch it for the first time. Gosh, and like throw a pill in there for books, too. I'd reread books for the first time.
I know. That magic feeling.
My hero is Danny Torrance, and especially after the addition of, if it was just The Shining, probably not, but Dr. Sleep.
Yeah.
There was just something about that novel that hit me hard. For those of you who don't know, Dr. Sleep brought us an adult version of Danny. He's all grown up. He still has the shine, but he's learned to, you know, kind of control it, and he's found ways to use it to help people. And I love that Stephen had him working in hospice care and helping dying people pass on, as someone who's always wanted to be a death doula. There was a cat named Azrael that they called Azzy because I had one too once.
So sweet.
I love that despite living through the trauma of having an alcoholic and abusive father, he still found himself abusing substances and becoming what he always feared and hated, because you and I, Lauren, talk a lot about generational trauma and also, you know, people that do fall into the same patterns as their parents. Like there's almost like a one or the other. You either grow up to never, ever touch alcohol, or you grow up to have the same issues. And it's like that with all sorts of mental health disorders. So I thought that was very interesting, and I loved reading about it. But I will say I've been becoming increasingly more and more in love with Holly Gibney after Mr. Mercedes, that series, and The Outsider. So I'm really excited for his upcoming book, because he's writing a book about Holly now, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you read If It Bleeds, the novella collection?
No, I haven't.
He's got a good story about Holly in there. That's
Does he?
The
okay.
title story. Yeah, that was actually the story that made me like her the most, was If It Bleeds, yeah.
I'm really into it, and I like the idea that he kind of seems to play with a little bit, where it's like, is she a hero or a villain?
Right.
Mm.
In the end? Like, how is she going to turn out in the end, if we get to see, you know, what she evolves into?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like I've always been pretty obsessed with the idea of people who have a sixth sense, like Danny and Holly have, possibly because I relate to it, having seen and heard and experienced strange phenomena my whole life. There's probably something there to psychoanalyze, but who has the time? So for villains, though, the villain that affected me the most was probably Mrs. Carmody from The Mist.
Oh my God.
She scared the ever-loving shit out of me. Of all the monsters and demons and ghosts Stephen King has written about, I love. Didn't we? Did all three of us pick
just normal people. Yeah, we did.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we sure did.
Yeah, as our favorite villains.
And this is why I need you to jog the memory, because absolutely she is up there. Yes.
Yeah, she's terrifying. A religious zealot who starts a cult in the middle of a grocery store. And as far as the movie, I mean, Marcia Gay Harden, mwah, delicious. Yeah. What a great performance. So but I read The Mist in about eighth grade, and at that same time, I was still in Lutheran school. And at that same time, I was butting heads with a lot of people, my teachers, my pastor, my mother, on the idea of religion and God. So I was ripe for the scaring with that one, with that lady. Stephen King is obviously most well known for his stories, but not always specifically his novels. In fact, there are a ton of people who don't read his books at all, but I guarantee they have seen his movies. So, question one, what are the best and worst Stephen King film adaptations? Oh, Randall.
I mean, it's such a hard thing to say, because I think for me, it's, you know, King will say that his favorite and the best adaptations are the ones that hew close to his books. He right. said that when we talked to him a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. That's true, I think, by and large, because I think yeah. you have to sort of have a respect for the work that... I wrote a piece for a publication called The Outline a few years ago about how the generation that grew up on King, they're now adapting movies, and their movies are a lot more reverent than a lot of the stuff that came out in the 80s and yeah. 90s of him, because those people didn't grow up on King. They were sort of, some of them loved him, like Rob Reiner, obviously, was yeah. a huge King fan and made Stand right. By Me, which is probably, in my opinion, the best King adaptation
probably
ever.
Probably so.
But, you know, most people, I think, were just trying to make a buck off him. So there wasn't a lot of passion, I think, to a lot of those adaptations. Whereas that's a little different now. Although, I will say, I think it's starting to change a little bit as the Stephen King IP grows. And there's a lot of duds out there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if I had to choose my favorites, it would be Stand By Me and The Shining, the Kubrick Shining, which I think is brilliant, even though it's a far, you know, cry from the book. It's yeah. just an incredible movie. But I will say Dr. Sleep isn't a movie I would say I'd revisit very often, but I would say it's one of the more impressive adaptations
yeah.
in the sense that it sort of has that tricky thing of having to reconcile like the Shining movie and book and the Dr. Sleep book, which mm-hmm. are all at odds with each other to some degree, like
yeah.
because it has to serve as both a sequel to Stanley Kubrick's The Shining and King's The Shining, and also honor the story of Dr. Sleep. So yeah. Mike Flanagan did an incredible job in terms
Agreed.
Of reconciling those things, I think, while honoring all three of them. And you know, for me, with a King movie adaptation, it's I think sticking close to the story helps, but mm-hmm. for me, it's really about capturing the essence, which again, it's a totally sort of ineffable thing that you can't quantify, but there is, like, I would even say the 94 Stand is not a grand achievement in storytelling or filmmaking, but I would say, I think in a lot of ways it captures the essence of that storytelling mode of King, which is the ensemble and the epic. There is something in that story that, or that adaptation, that I think really does speak to like the general vibes of King,
yeah.
which is a little bit silly, but also, and a little bit earnest, but also, you know, ambitious, I think, and also, you know, scary at times. There are moments in that, as corny as it can be at times, it is pretty creepy. So, and then worst adaptations, I think my least favorite thing I've ever seen that is a King adaptation, and this is saying something because there's a lot of bad ones, is probably the Under the Dome TV series, which
yeah.
I just despise. I think it is
rough.
I think it's a cynical and sort of, It's also just sucks. Like, it's not
yeah.
good. And then, yeah. and then it all, but it also like tries to turn a, it tries to take a book that is pretty self-contained, you know, both literally and figuratively mm-hmm. and tries to turn it into IP. And there's something really cynical about that, and I don't enjoy it. And I mean, that's the problem, right? And this is something we're encountering constantly with new adaptations, because everything has to be a franchise now, and everything, mm-hmm. You know, and that's the thing about Hollywood, is they're desperate to turn King into IP. His name is IP, but they want franchises,
right.
and he doesn't give that to them except for The Dark Tower. And The Dark Tower, they've tried and they've failed because it's so ambitious.
Yeah.
And And you know, and I think they just keep hiring the wrong people to do it. Except for, I will say, the unaired Amazon pilot. We have an episode about it, and we talked to the creator. I think that had the most potential of anything to be a good Dark Tower, but they axed it. So, so you know, there's a lot to say there. But you know, even the new Firestarter that came out, which I didn't think was as bad as everyone said it was, they were also trying to set up a sequel. Like, yeah. Everything has to be IP now. They're trying to do that It prequel on HBO. And maybe it'll be good. Who knows? But yeah. King kind of scoffed at it in our interview, and some publications picked that up. Because he was just kind of like, I don't really care. You know, it's like, he's like, I have
it's
nothing
not
to
my
do
story.
With it. And he's like, I'm not into it.
This is like the forming of Pennywise, right? Isn't that?
And that's the thing, is he only glances at that and in such a compelling way in the book that I don't want to know more, because I love what he gives us.
And why do we need it?
And my whole thing is, I'm just like, I don't trust a bunch of modern TV writers to give me the origin of one of the greatest villains of all time. Like, you know, like, I want King to give me that if somebody's going to give me that, and he's not involved. So
I'm more interested in HBO's The Overlook Hotel series that they want to do, because
sadly that has been axed.
It has. No.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I think some of the people that were working on that went to the Dairy Show, so because I think that and the thing is that Overlook show must have been bad if they canceled it, because that is like slam dunk IP right there.
Jeez. It seems like it would be really great,
especially if you did take, you know, because there's so many things with you know, obviously when you ask people about, you know, what your favorite adaptation is, a lot of people will say The Shining, and then a lot of people will say absolutely not The Shining. It was not Stephen's story at all. But there are some little things that if you read The Shining after you watch Kubrick's version that are so brilliant, like, for example, the shot of the dog costume. You know, it's explained. Like, you can actually go in and read the book and find out what the dog was all about. And so, like, having an Overlook series, I think, would have been really interesting. But c'est la vie. What about you, Lauren? What are your favorite adaptations and, you know, worst adaptations?
Oh, gosh. I feel like all of mine will be hot takes, but I'm going to put them out there anyway. I absolutely love Carrie. I think it is so well done, and Sissy Spacek is just
perfect.
Also, Stand By Me. I mean, you have to love it. And it also brings in just those four boys, like the friendship that we were talking about before.
Well,
anytime
you're making a movie that focuses on children as your main cast is a gamble.
Totally.
Yeah, those four kids are incredible.
I mean, like, some of the best performances I've ever seen. Yeah.
Yeah.
I still can't believe that Jerry O'Connell is one of them. And every time they tell me that's him, I'm like, you're a liar and a thief, because that is not Jerry O'Connell. That's not my Jerry. Yes, I will love Stand By Me forever. It is so well done. Also, Misery, like, just slap me over the face with it a million times. I will watch Misery forever. I think Kathy Bates is so perfect in
She's
it.
Great.
And it honestly is like what I wanted after reading. Yeah. And also, this is the one that I think will be a hot take. I really love 1408.
Oh, 1408.
I like 1408.
Okay, good.
I prefer
that's the one
the
I was
short
like embarrassed
story,
to say.
But I like
sure.
Yeah.
I thought
funny
it was
story.
Well done.
In 2017, I did a podcast appearance on a friend of mine's show here in Chicago, and I just started Losers Club, and he's like, when you do 1408, you got to have me on. And I was like, that'll be like 3 years from now, dude. And it's been five, and we're only about to get to it this summer. And I'm still going to have him on, because I promised him at the time I'd do that, because he says it is his favorite horror movie of all time.
Wow.
So I'm like, I want to hear your take, man.
Okay.
But I'm interested in hearing it too.
I was like, I can't wait to listen to that, because I do really enjoy it. I would not give it that same credit.
So, I think we all feel that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it'll be fun.
It's like, it's good, but.
It's good, yeah.
Okay. Well,
we tried to get John Cusack, and he won't do it, and we're annoyed about it.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's annoying.
That's your exclusive that I'm going to give you guys is we tried to get John Cusack, and he is completely disinterested in coming on.
Oh,
podcast,
come
so.
On.
Very annoyed about it.
Well, I'll try to get him on ours.
I'm sure he'll
He's
say yes.
He's a Chicago
to
guy. He should want to be on our pod.
Right?
Or whatever.
Well, we definitely have more of the pull, so don't worry, we'll handle it. I guess for worst, it's hard because, like, top of my list, it also was not a good book. And Randy, I think you brought it up earlier, but Dreamcatcher.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I had hope in because of the cast, and then it was like, nope, still not good. So yeah. That comes to
Dreamcatcher was on my list, too.
It made me
sad.
I
think one of the best adaptations I've seen might be 1922.
It's really good.
That movie seemed like it was word for word. I mean, I had read it. I haven't reread it since I watched it, so I absolutely could be wrong. But as far as I can tell, that was pretty close and also a really great movie if you are okay with slow burns. I know a lot of horror fans want a little bit more action, but I was totally down with it. I didn't love Dreamcatcher. And I did not love this year's Firestarter, and I had reread it to come talk about it too, so it was so fresh. And I a lot of the reboots, like Carrie, Pet Sematary, Firestarter, It Chapter 1 and 2 were pretty close, but the recent reboots seemed to me to stray the most. Like I keep thinking when they remake Christine, it's going to be like a Tesla whose AI has gone haywire, and it's like that's a different
that's literally
story.
What they did with Child's Play.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where it's like that's not Charles Lee Ray.
Really
that's a fucking computer chip malfunction. Like that's a different story.
If they make Christine a Tesla, we're lighting something on fire.
Well, you know they are doing a new Christine. It's Brian Fuller, the guy who did Hannibal, which the other guys are excited about on my pod because they like Hannibal, but I don't dislike Hannibal. I just haven't watched it,
right.
But I'm not a huge like Fuller head otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I'm skeptical, especially because I think the Carpenter Christine is pretty solid. It's not perfect. The end is kind of a mess.
Of course. Yeah. They did, you know, what they could there at the end, but yeah. I think that's actually, I was going to say, my all-time favorite Stephen King adaptation is Christine. I just think one has ever made a car be that scary, and no one will ever be able to make a car that scary again.
I agree.
And I know there, you know, like I said, there are talks of it being remade, but honestly, watch the original. It's Stephen King. It's got great performances, an amazing score, winner, winner, chicken dinner. I fucking love Christine.
We're doing a film festival in Chicago, a Stephen King film festival this fall, and we're hoping to get Keith Gordon from Christine to come by. So, yeah, we'll see if it happens, but, you know, we love Keith Gordon.
So, question number two on the films, why do you think it seems so difficult? And we did kind of cover this, but why do you think it seems so difficult to adapt his work from page to screen?
Oh, gosh.
Because I feel like there are more duds than there are.
Well, because, and, you know, you mentioned this earlier, like the characters are so well drawn and it takes and like, you know, anyone can sort of can, you know, take a plot and put it on page, but it's capturing the essence of the characters and what makes them special.
Yeah.
And a lot of that has to do with performances. It has to do with the writing and all these other things. I mean, and, you know, honestly, the funny thing is King is not the best adapter of his own work. Like, that's something we've talked about a lot on the pod is, and, you know, we just talked about The Dead Zone pretty intensely. And there was a great quote from one of the screenwriters, or maybe it was Cronenberg himself, and he was basically like Steve's draft of The Dead Zone was really kind of gory, like unnecessarily gory and like not character driven, which is like what we wanted from him. Like, because I think he loves the, when it comes to movies, and this is very apparent, especially when you look at Maximum Overdrive, is he loves the big bangs, you know, zoom, gore. Like he sees the cinematic experience as a very big, broad and silly one by and large. Like, or at least that's what he tries to create. And like he wants to thrill the audience. I think he's a little scared about giving them intense character stuff. That's something he'll do from in the books. Well, so I think sometimes in his screenplays, he'll sort of veer from the stuff that makes his characters more compelling in favor of more spectacle. But I mean, he's, you know, we think that we're actually defenders of the 1990 Pet Sematary movie. We think it's pretty good.
I love it.
Yeah, it's not brilliant. Some people hate it. And so, and then he did the Lisi story series on Apple, which is a dense watch, but it definitely captures the book. And it has some cool stuff in it, but it's kind of a dense watch. But yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that too many of them focus on the horror elements and not on the soft, gentle, sentimental, the human connection, the sides which are, in our opinion, his best sides. But, you know, totally. It's also hard to, I think, to bring the scares because when you're reading about a giant bird chasing a small boy, you know, you've got your own head movies and right. they are scary. And then, uh-huh. you know, when someone else does it, I mean, completely ignoring the fact that most of it has to be computer generated horror these days, which automatically takes away a lot of the scare factor for me.
Absolutely.
Sometimes it's just silly. Like in The Shining, there was no maze in the book. It was actually a lawn full of like trimmed bushes. It was the big topiaries yeah. that are shaped like different right. animals and creatures. And they attack Jack Torrance. And it's so scary in the book because like they don't move if you're looking at them.
Yeah,
it's like
I love that.
The weeping angels from Doctor Who. And if you look away, they can move and bite you and shit. And it's so scary. But that is ridiculous to put on film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just look at the miniseries.
Yeah.
Man.
It just won't come across.
It just won't. It won't come across yeah. as scary, at least.
Right.
It'll come across as something.
Scary I was going to say, I think that's part of the reason that it, chapter two, didn't come across as well. I think it was. But again, I don't know if I can blame the filmmakers. I still really enjoyed it. I feel like, Ashley, you liked it a little less when we talked yeah. about it last. But I felt like all of the CGI of the monsters that were trying to come to life just like was not,
yeah.
it was not coming across in how I wanted it. Whereas in the first one, there was a lot more scare. I actually thought the first chapter did a better job of adapting the book. And I was sort of like, oh, these were some of the things I was imagining. And it was a lot more about the characters as mm-hmm. we've been discussing. So that felt like king. Whereas in chapter two, I was like, oh, these CGI creatures are just not, like my imagination was so much scarier than what they put on yeah. the screen. So that's
well, I think,
it's tough.
The Losers Club, you guys actually talked about it and you put it in a way that I think is correct with the It chapters 1 and 2. They kind of did themselves a disservice by splitting it, the kids in one movie and the adults mm-hmm. in the other, because yeah. that was something that was so great about the book is going back and forth between the two.
Definitely. Yeah.
And that was, I think, a huge problem that they had because, yes, we did know these characters, but, like, we didn't know them as adults. Like, if you met me mm-hmm. as a child and then met me as an adult, those are two completely different people. Like, you have to right. reintroduce them, and I don't feel like they did at all. They just sort of were like, remember? Remember Beth?
Remember?
And the thing is, like, the kid's storyline is just so much more interesting than
it
the adult's
it
one.
It is.
Like,
yeah, again, yeah. the first one was just better because of the story. But also, it's like, it could have been harder to do to make the best movie doing the back and forth. And I think with Lisey's story, didn't they, I don't know if this is true. I actually haven't watched the series on Apple TV, but I thought I read that like they don't do like the storyline the same way that the book did. Is that true at all?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Structurally, it's they do change it a little bit. I think it mostly works. It's just like, there is something sort of languid about it, which I think also extends yeah. to the book itself, which King says is his favorite book he's ever written because I think he associates it with his wife quite a yeah. bit because he wrote it for her. Totally. But it's to me, it's a tough read, and it's okay. There's parts of it that I think are wonderful, but you know, it's incredibly long as is the series.
It is long, but I somehow read it, and again, I don't know if that's just like the dark, depressing side of me, but I thought it was so fascinating, and I liked that it was tied to when he came home from the hospital and saw mm-hmm. that his wife yeah. had kind of moved things around and was like, oh, this is what it would be like if I died. Like, that is such yeah. an interesting inspiration. But
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, which is why I also think he has such a connection to it. It's you know, it's one of those stories that I think came really from really deep in his soul, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, one thing I think we have to at least mention in this episode is the Stephen King universe. Before the MCU, Stephen King was creating his own universe inside his novels, where you'd get to run into characters from other books in the other novels and places. Because so many of his books not only take place in the same towns and times, they also seem to take place in the same world. So just general discussion, how do you feel about the shared Stephen King universe? Are you a fan, not a fan? Do you have any favorite crossover moments?
Yeah, I always loved it when I was younger. I think I lost a little bit of enthusiasm for it as I've gotten older because just because he does it all the time now. Yeah, like right. every book of his has crossovers. Like Billy Summer specifically has sort of some very overt ones, as does later his the book he wrote before that. Both good books, but I almost don't need the crossovers.
Right.
And I think it can be good, but it can also be a little distracting, or it can sort of remind you of better books, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And but I will say, like, there are times that it's incredibly satisfying. And I think I mentioned, like, Ace Merrill earlier, right? Like, mm-hmm. him popping up in the body and then returning in Needful Things. Just the dissonance between the two versions of Ace that we see says so much about who he is as a person. And it's incredibly powerful to me. And yeah, so I kind of appreciate that aspect of it. And I think at times it's done really well. I mean, just Castle Rock always worked well for me because all those characters are so vividly drawn, and the way he spreads them out and uh-huh. constantly references the history of Castle Rock. Like,
yeah.
like, you know, the events of Cujo, the events of Dead Zone, those ripple throughout the later books, like Needful Things. And even a lot of the novellas, like the what was it? The dog one, I'm forgetting the name of the Sun Dog. The Sun Dog. Like that's a good Castle Rock story. And so yeah, those are it's cool the way that he can do that and build this town that really does feel populated by real people and who have real lives, you know?
Yeah.
So so I think I like it, but it feels a little bit more like, you know, in movies when there's just references for the sake of references.
Yeah.
Like it's not actually interwoven into the story. I kind of feel like King's doing that a little bit in his later books, just because I think he enjoys the sandbox that he's created and he likes playing around in it. But, you know, especially in the 90s, I think that was when I liked it the most because it still felt relatively novel. Like I'll always remember reading the afterword in Wizard and Glass, which is my favorite Dark Tower book. And he sort of teases the larger multiverse and how it's going to incorporate into later Dark Tower books at the end of that book. And I remember being thrilled by that.
Yeah.
Like that was the sort of thing I was on message boards reading people talk about their theories, you know? I think that was when it had the most pull and power for me was then. But now it kind of feels like second nature, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I do like sometimes, you know, it does seem almost as if he's, in the case of like Holly Gibney, for example, mm-hmm. where those are two completely different stories and her involvement in them are completely different. But it almost seems like he wrote the story and then he was like, I like her and I gotta see her again. And stuff yeah. like that I really enjoy because I felt the same way where I was like, I like her. And so when right. I did read The Outsider and she was there, I was like, no fucking way. That's so exciting.
Well, she's like his Jack Reacher now.
I do too. And I don't mind. I'm in.
Those are the kind of books he loves to read too. Because in our newsletter, I always chronicle his recommendations. And he, you know, he's one of those guys who loves like the dime store paperbacks of like, you know, the continuing adventures of this character, you know, by this one author.
Yeah.
And I think in his old age, like he loves reading that and he wants to have one of his own. And that's what Holly is for him.
That's a good way to kind of summarize it. I don't really have much more to add than what you guys have said is I think he's getting to the point of he's just having fun with it now.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
before, maybe there was a little more thought behind it and like, oh, these have to cross over for this specific reason. Then as time has gone on, it's sort of just like, hey, these are all my people. This is the town I've made. And like, let's have a little fun with it, which he has every right to do in his 70s still writing away. So I like it. I think it's fun.
Yeah.
Especially, I always like when there's like a quick crossover, like a meet in passing. And then you're just like, oh, I saw that little nugget, which yeah. is a good time.
One of my favorite realizations came through when I read, and I'm not going to apologize for it. I love 11/22/63. I loved it.
You do?
And I won't apologize. Yes.
Hey, you don't have to. I'm just surprised because I didn't. I feel like I'm usually on your same page.
Yeah.
Wait, 11/22, the book?
The book. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like that's one of his most celebrated later novels. I'm just surprised to hear you, like...
every time I bring it up. Every time I bring it up, they're like, ugh.
I don't think it's hated. I wasn't into it. I'm in the minority for sure.
Yeah, I do love that book.
I love it. And it's definitely one where, like, Joe, when he read it, he was like, I can't keep reading it. And I was like, keep going. Like, it's one of those where, like, it's so satisfying when you finish it. It's so good. But I'd obviously read stories before with some crossover characters or crossover locations, you know. And I know one moment that stood out to me, though, is in Dolores Claiborne. She has this moment of like psychic abilities and she sees a woman tied to a bed. And it's so split second, they don't even revisit it. And you find out, obviously, later that it was Gerald's game. So,
yep.
But
yep.
In 11/22/63, the main character Jake has traveled back to Maine in 1958. And at one point, he makes his way through Derry. And he's at a bar. He hears someone bring up a psycho dressed as a clown terrorizing kids. And that's already like, ooh, like so exciting. But then he's walking through and he runs into Bevy and Richie. And This takes place basically after the childhood events of it. But he runs into them and they just have a small exchange. But he notices something different about them. And they notice something different about him. And that was my big moment of realizing that the shine, made famous by The Shining, obviously. But the shine is something that a lot of Stephen's characters have. Some of them have a lot of it, like Danny Torrance, Holly Gibney, Johnny Smith, and The Dead Zone. But I think even Jake has a bit of it. And, you know, Charlie and Firestarter has some of it. Mother Abigail in The Stand references it directly, which I didn't know at the time because I just read The Stand. But she says, my grandmother used to call it the shining lamp of God, sometimes just the shine.
Oh, yeah.
So The Shine is my all-time favorite part of his universe. And I think it is the connector to every one of his stories. Because even if they don't have, you know, Jake doesn't have a psychic ability, but he does, there is something different about him. He travels through time, you know. So
pretty
in
special.
A way, he is a psychic because he can tell you what happens after that day. Sure. I love that. Okay, we have time for one more question. And this question's mostly for me because one of my favorite bad movies to consume, we mentioned it a little bit. It's a little ditty from 1986 called Maximum Overdrive. And this is a movie based on a short story by Stephen King called Trucks, where all the cars, trucks, buses, planes, trains, and automobiles of the world come to life and become killing machines. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the only movie Stephen King has ever directed. And after this masterpiece, he vowed to never direct again. But I disagree. I think Stephen should absolutely direct again if it means we get to watch a soda machine kill a grown man and a steamroller roll over a bunch of Little Leaguers. And also AC/DC does the soundtrack.
I was about to say the soundtrack. So good.
My question for you guys is, if he could have directed any of his other works that have been made into a movie or not, which one would you have wanted to see and what rock band would you do the soundtrack?
Is it wrong to say I want to see him take another stab at Maximum Overdrive?
Nope.
Like,
no.
What if...
Try it again,
what if
man.
He could do it Let's better this time? Yeah, I want to see what happens. And instead of AC/DC, do like Guns N' Roses. So we're still along the same line, but a little different.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'll take it.
I would love it. I would also like to see Salem's Lot directed by Stephen King. I don't know. I think I would like to see the way he takes his words and puts them into a movie. I can't even explain it more than that. I think he needs to be moving people around in that one. I don't know why.
The Weeknd can do the soundtrack for that one. Randall, do you have an answer?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I never had my moment with Maximum Overdrive. Other guys on the pod, they like it a little more than me because they watched it when they were young. I didn't see it until I was older, so that was just one I always missed. So I don't think I have any nostalgia attached to it, and I just kind of see it as like a headache of a movie kind of. but you know, he was so coked out.
I was
when
gonna
he
say
it.
That he'll, movie he'll, is he'll, fueled by cocaine.
That's
yeah,
why we need and, one with sobriety.
Yeah, and I'd love to see a sober adaptation of the one. I thought about this question quite a bit, and what I landed on was The Long Walk. Do you know The Long Walk?
Yes.
I don't think I do, actually.
It's a Bachman book. My favorite Bachman book, and I'm not a big fan of his Bachman stuff, but that one is about, it's kind of a dystopian world in which, you know, like I think 100 boys walk, and the last one who makes it sort of, you know, is kind of granted a blank check by the supreme potentate of this world. And it's a story about friendship and about male bonding, and even to some degree, I think, a friendship that borders on romantic love and lust among boys. And that's sort of a subtextual aspect of it that I'm not even sure King was fully aware of when he wrote it, because he wrote it when he was extremely young. And I think it's a pretty straightforward story that contains a lot of, I don't know, a lot of areas to explore. But it's also a relatively muted story in a lot of ways, despite the fact that there's a lot of, you know, violence in it. It's really about these conversations that unfold between these boys as they're walking. And I would love to see him do something that's sort of the polar opposite of Maximum Overdrive and be like, can you do something, a small character driven piece, you know?
Yeah.
Like a piece that has a relatively small ensemble, really character focused, and also really about, I guess, like dudes, like male friendship.
Right.
Because I, you know, I mean, King has tried to be more diverse as he's gotten older, I think rightly so. I mean, his early work, you know, you can see his evolution in terms of becoming more culturally aware. I mean, he was a small kid and he grew up, you know, poor in Maine. He wasn't born in the upper echelons of New York or something. So he had a lot of biases and a lot of things to get over in his work, and he'll openly admit that. But, you know, he always did, though, write male friendship really well, especially young male friendship. I mean, Stand By Me is a great example. You know, Bev is obviously a wonderful character, but then you see so much great interactions between the boys.
Yeah.
And Dreamcatcher, even some of the best parts of Dreamcatcher is the way he sort of captures the male friendship in the early part of that book between these four guys. And so I'd love to see him, you know, if he could transmit that cinematically with this story, which has never had a film adaptation. Reportedly, there's one in the works by the guy who did, what's it called? Yeah, The Autopsy of Jane Doe, the guy who did in the Scary Stories movie.
Oh, yeah.
He's supposedly directing it. I'm not sure where it's at right now. Sadly, Frank Darabont optioned it and wanted to do it. You know, the guy who did Shawshank and Green
and
Mile.
The he's
and
so
the
good at adapting Stephen King, so that is sad
he's the
that
best.
He's not.
Yeah,
him and Rob Reiner were the ones who got King the best out of all the directors.
Yeah.
And, you know, I interviewed Darabont a few years ago, and he basically is like, because, you know, he helped co-create The Walking Dead, and he had a really bad relationship with AMC. And I think there was a lot of legal acrimony, and I think he kind of said, fuck it, I'm done with Hollywood. Like, his legacy's intact.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm out of here.
Well, I still can.
You're done.
Yeah, he described it as he was like a World War II plane that, you know, landed with a broken wing and a broken wheel and everything. And he just wanted to, you know, live his life in Northern California.
Yeah, retire.
Away from Hollywood. Yeah, I think he was really burnt out because I asked him, I'm like, you know, I know you had optioned The Long Walk, and he's like, yeah, I had to give it up because I knew I was never going to make it, you know, because
he's like,
it's just not going to happen. Yeah. And it's, I mean, he's got a wonderful filmography behind him, but I think he got so burned out by modern Hollywood. And so, yeah, I guess that I would love to see, it just comes back around. I would love to see King sort of, you know, explore a character-based piece. And so, yeah, I thought of The Long Walk.
The Long Walk is so good. I was like, the last thing I'll say on it, Ashley, I just wanted, the reason I know about it is, again, because of my dad, but I described it actually recently to somebody because I was like, it felt like the pre, like, Hunger Games or Squid Game, which I know is dramatic because it's a lot less intense than those, but I feel like it almost, like, paved the way for those, kind of that same idea of, like, this contestant of following rules or die, fighting to the death, but it's in such a more character-driven way, exactly what you said. So I do think seeing that movie come to life would be so special.
I do feel like, I could be making this up, it's been a while since we talked about it, but I do feel like Suzanne Collins might have noted Long Walk as an inspiration for Hunger Games. I could be wrong,
really?
But it makes total sense. I mean,
that does make
it's
sense.
Like so easy to see it in the DNA of that show, of that book series. Yeah.
I was going to say something that's happened a lot recently. I read something on The Mist that was wrong and the remake of Firestarter that was wrong. And it would probably happen with The Long Walk too, where like someone was like, Firestarter, this looks a lot like Stranger Things. And it's like, first of all.
Okay.
Read a book. But I read that with The Mist, too, where it was like, Stephen King obviously doesn't like Christians or trust our military because, and it's like, that book was written in like 1979. He didn't write it today.
Well, that's such a funny critique, too, because I will say, when he did write it, he did distrust the military and Christians a lot more. These days, if you follow his Twitter account, he is the biggest Joe Biden fan on the planet. So
loved him.
It is, Yeah, he has softened, I think, a little bit in his political paranoia. Definitely. Which is, I love that about his earlier work, but yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how he feels about Christians these days. I think he mostly stays away from it, but it's, but it is, I love it whenever he writes about religion. I find his, like, Desperation is a great book, in my opinion. A lot of people don't like it, but that's a great exploration of his view of God through the lens of sobriety, and then merging that, I think, with Christianity, so.
Yeah, I've heard him in a few interviews say, like, God, I believe in God, I just don't believe in religion. You know what I mean? And that's kind of, you know, Lauren and I can relate to that quite a bit. But the movie I would have Stephen King direct would be Dreamcatcher, because Dreamcatcher was bad, but not in a good way. And if it's going to be bad, it might as well be good. So I would have loved to have seen what wacky things Stephen did with aliens coming out of butts. And I think the Mr. Gray Jonesy hybrid would have been cock-a-doodle-doo, and he would have been real over the top with the army. And I don't remember his name, but the psychotic officer who Morgan Freeman plays in the movie. And yes. And I chose to give the soundtrack over to Twisted Sister. So I did stay in the same
Vein. Oh yeah, I didn't say a soundtrack. I'd say Bruce Springsteen.
Oh,
Bruce Springsteen for a long walk.
Okay.
Have the boss for the perfect. Long walk. I'm into it. I'm into that. You guys nailed it.
So that is actually all the time we have this week for Keep It Weird. But thank you guys so much for tuning in week after week. And thank you so much, Randall, for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was a total blast.
We couldn't have created a better guest for this episode in a lab. Everyone, please check out the Losers Club podcast if you want to hear more in-depth discussions on the works of Stephen King. But as you were saying earlier, it's not just about Stephen's literary works. They discuss his movies. I know you guys have done episodes on Stranger Things. You do episodes on other works of horror. You just did a Jurassic Park episode. Like,
that, you did a Jurassic Park episode. I can't wait.
Well, that was that was a Patreon up. We had this series called The Crate, and it was basically like our patrons could vote on movies that we talk about, and they want us to talk about Jurassic Park, and we unlocked it for June because we're taking a little sort of it's Blockbuster Month, which is our way of saying we're going to unlock some of those movie episodes and take a little bit of a break. We're still doing new episodes, but you know, just to kind of direct people towards there. So we don't have a ton of, like, I'd say pretty much everything in our Patreon and beyond is Stephen King or Stephen King adjacent. But, like, we talk a lot about things that are inspired by him, like Stranger Things is one example. And we have a spinoff right now going through the seasons because we're pretty big fans of that show. And but yeah, the Jurassic Park episode is awesome. It's just
I think
we're stretching it a little bit when we say finding Stephen King in Jurassic Park. It's like, no, we just want to talk about Jurassic Park.
So. Which is fair, and it's fine.
But yeah, there's something for everyone there, even if you haven't read every single book.
That's very true.
Join us next time as we venture into some true crime with a twist. But until then, please follow us on Instagram at KeepItWeirdCast. Follow Randall on Instagram at Randall Colburn and his podcast at The Losers Club Podcast. And make sure you check out our Patreon to get bonus episodes of our show, discounts on merch from our merch store, and a monthly newsletter full of weird news, stories, upcoming movies, books, and video games, and so much more. Randall, what should our sign-off be this week?
Long days and pleasant nights, which is what we say in the Losers Club.
Hey, long days and pleasant nights. And keep it weird.
Want a balloon, Ben?
They float.
They all float.
Come here, son. You'll like it down there.
You'll never have to grow up.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at caskers.com.